From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Michael Kinsley dissects the political and social scenes with his cutting wit. Kinsley edits The New Republic and writes that magazine's influential TRB column. Also today, I talk with Stephen Davis. His new book, Say Kids, What Time Is It?, is a history of TV's first hit kids program, The Howdy Doody Show. Guitarist Bob Brosman plays a couple of tunes from the 30s, and Ken Tucker reviews O.C. and Stigs, a Robert Altman film that you can only see on home video. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In Michael Kinsley's new collection of political and social essays, he writes this: "The short attention span of Americans is a continuous blessing for journalists and politicians. We can whip up a nice froth of hysteria on any subject we wish without much fear that the audience will complain, 'Wait a minute, we're still hysterical over the matter you were importuning us about last month.'" Well, Kinsley whips up his readers on a weekly basis with his TRB column in The New Republic. Kinsley is also the editor of The New Republic. He's a former editor of Harper's and is credited with being the individual most responsible for that magazine's recovery. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. His fellow journalist, Christopher Hitchens, calls Kinsley a master of ridicule and a foe of sentimentality. I spoke with Michael Kinsley earlier today from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Kinsley took over the TRB column in 1983 from Richard Strout, who had written it for over 40 years and retired at the age of 85. I asked Kinsley why he kept the TRB byline instead of changing it to his own.
Well, it's a great advantage to inherit one, of course. You know, it had a following, it had a tradition. Dick Strout had been doing it for 43 years, and I have friends who've tried to start a column, and it's far more difficult.
Do you think of yourself as fitting neatly into any political categories of, you know, liberal, conservative, neoconservative, neoliberal?
Oh, well, I think I'm basically a liberal, and I'm associated with people like my former boss, Charlie Peters, who's editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who call themselves neoliberals. As I say in this book, I consider myself a liberal, but I don't consider it important enough to get into a fight with people who don't think I deserve the label.
Do you think that most people want to know how you define yourself so that they can decide in advance whether or not they agree with you?
Oh, I think that's part of it. I don't take the position, the snotty position a lot of people have that, oh, labels are unimportant. I think labels are very important. They're very useful. And I think you can give the words liberal and conservative and even neoliberal do have meaning and are worth trying to apply. But I think that there are going to be exceptions. No one is going to fit the label perfectly.
So, defining yourself as a liberal, why don't you define liberal?
Well, I think a liberal is a person who believes in domestic social policy matters and in an activist role for the central government, the federal government. I think the difference between a neoliberal and a paleoliberal, as you might call them, is that a neoliberal is skeptical about many government programs we have now. But unlike, say, a neoconservative who used to be a liberal and now thinks it's all rubbish, a neoliberal is someone who says, look, there are better ways of doing things, but the principle that the government needs to play an active role in preventing poverty and in managing the economy is that's a neoliberal.
But you think of yourself as a liberal, not a neoliberal?
Oh, no, I don't mind. I mean, the problem with the term neoliberal is not that I disagree with it. It's become a marketing term for a lot of people who feel very strongly they want to push this label. I'm not particularly of that school. But I'm happy enough if someone wants to call me a neoliberal, sure.
I'm sure your pieces really upset a lot of your readers.
I hope so.
The pieces that you've written, which is the one that's upset the liberals the most and which has upset conservatives the most?
I think the one that upset the liberals the most of the pieces in this book was a book review I wrote of Jonathan Schell's The Fate of the Earth. It's very hard to recall now, but at the time that book was published in 1982, and it ran originally in The New Yorker, it was treated rapturously. It was as if all life on Earth must stop before in order to appreciate the importance of this book. And in fact, one reviewer actually wrote that Knopf, the publishing firm, the publisher, should cancel the rest of its list for that year so that everyone would only read this book. And I wrote, I believe, the first negative review of this book, which struck me as extremely silly.
Do you want to explain the basic premise of the book for our listeners?
The basic premise, the basic premise of the book was nuclear war is this awful, awful thing, and it was the sort of flagship book of the anti-nuclear movement, which I think accomplished a lot of very good things. I don't think we'd be having President Reagan would be on the verge of signing an arms control treaty today if it hadn't been for the people he has nothing good to say about who were campaigning for it back in the early 80s. However, this book took as its premise that that nuclear weapons must be wiped off the face of the earth, that any other consideration, such as protecting our freedoms, was irrelevant in the face of the ultimate peril. And it was just a bunch of, I read it in absolute astonishment, thinking this is this overheated rhetoric, completely nonsensical. And everyone was greeting it as if it was, a new book of the Bible. And when I wrote that, I got a lot of extremely hostile response from liberals, including my boss at that time, the chairman of the board of Harper's. And but I think the world has come around to my point of view on Jonathan Schell. I think that book and that whole episode is hardly ever remembered today, whereas back at the time, everyone was virtually certain that this was going to be recalled as one of the towering books of our century.
What about the piece that got conservatives most upset?
I have to look at the table of contents here. I guess it would be The Case for Glee, which was something I wrote less than a year ago, last Christmas time, saying it's perfectly all right to say it was about when Reagan was first getting enmeshed in the Iran-Contra scandal, and everyone was saying, oh, this is a terrible tragedy, and I wrote a piece saying, look, it's wonderful, he deserves it.
Is this the piece where you wrote, Reagan's come up and says democracy is salvation?
That's right, and the last lines of it were ha, 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 that stirred up, I thought, an amazing amount of fuss, considering it was just a little column.
My guest is Michael Kinsley. He's the editor of The New Republic, and he also writes the TRB column, which is syndicated. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. Now, you wrote one piece in which you compared George Bush to a dog that's really learned how to take commands from its master. Have you ever run into George Bush since writing that column?
Well, he's not the kind of person you bump into at the grocery store. No, I don't.
But
think
you go to lots of places besides grocery stores.
Well, I don't go to places where I've never met George Bush. And about a year after I wrote that, George Will, who certainly does run into George Bush in places, wrote a column using the exact same metaphor. I called him a puppy dog, and George Will called him a lap dog. And I'm sure that was. It was much more embarrassing for him than it was for me.
Some of your funniest pieces are about journalistic cliches. One piece is about bad headlines that you found, and the title of the piece is Worthwhile Canadian Initiative, which you thought was just the ultra boring headline. And people apparently were sending you in lots of dull headlines after that. Are you still getting bad headlines?
They've tapered off. It's probably time to write another piece to generate some more, but there are certainly no end of them. I got a lot of hostile response from Canadians who felt it was unfair to say that a headline was made boring just because it had the word Canadian in it.
Well, I think the words worthwhile initiative are also have the ring of dullness to them.
Well, the whole thing was so sort of terminally high-minded. What could it possibly be, this worthwhile Canadian initiative? It could be anything involving the future of NATO. There are other geographical regions. European unity. It's not just Canada that can be boring.
Do you have any favorites?
Let me look it up in the book. We're slowing things down here while I reread my own book, which I'm enjoying terribly much. Oh, here's one: A Sound Compromise on UN Budgeting. Oh, and then there was a little, my friends at the Washington Post and I exchanged headlines we think are boring, and then we got into bylines. By Elliot L. Richardson is an especially boring byline. Hyattsville building still closed. Pan Am jumbo jet lands safely. Library group confers on vexing issues. And then tribal fighting in Papua New Guinea, nothing to worry about, officials say. As if you were going to worry about, as if you were, the best ones are the ones that tell you something going on far away is something you don't really have to think about, which of course you weren't thinking about anyway.
These would be hard to top, I think.
Yeah.
Do you get to write your own headlines for your columns and pieces?
Yeah, well, since I'm the editor, I get to write the headlines for mine and for other people's. But, you know, it's a cooperative effort at the New Republic. And we do our best not to make our headlines boring. Sometimes I think we're sort of misrepresenting articles to our readers by making them sound a little bit more exciting than they might really be. But
example?
Well, I'm not going to give you any examples of
the dull article and the good headline.
Of the New Republic, but I'll just say that I tell the other editors there when someone says, oh, we can't call it that, that's misrepresenting the piece. I said the Federal Trade Commission does not investigate false labeling of magazine articles.
You also put down some bad journalistic cliches like there are no easy answers and catchphrases like thoughtful observers say blah, blah, blah. I guess it's really convenient when you're stuck to pull out a cliche like that. Do you find yourself ever resorting to it?
Oh, I had a frightening episode just this past week where I was talking to the op-ed editor of one of the newspapers that publishes my column, who was saying, you know, what I really like about your stuff is a lot of people, as they get older, they start issuing pleas for leadership, and you've never done that. And I was just staring at my computer screen where I was just composing, a piece about the budget deficit, which everyone's writing about. And I was about to issue a plea for leadership. So she saved me from that.
You've appeared on several of the Sunday morning talk shows, the news and analysis talk shows. Do each of those shows have a different protocol, a different etiquette book that you have to follow before you get on?
Well, I'm not invited to the onto the ones that show much display of having any etiquette book at all. I mean, I've done McLaughlin Group, which certainly, if there's an etiquette book there, I don't know what it could possibly say.
Unhinge yourself.
And the CNN Crossfire, which is also etiquette is not a word that you think of in connection with that show either.
Well, one of your essays, you said.
I'd be very curious as to what the hoity-toityer shows are like. A couple weeks ago, they let me on to Face the Nation, and I tried to be a bit more polite, but I think they only wanted me because they had Pat Buchanan, and they were hoping to get a little bit less polite.
Let me ask you, do you think that a lot of those shows find it easier to bring on someone from the right than they do to bring on their real counterpart from the left?
I think in a way, I benefit from the fact that all these, the spectrum of columnists and commentators is definitely skewed to the right. And I think I'm about as far left as you're permitted to get, which in my opinion is not very far left. I mean, I think by any reasonable standards, I'm sort of moderate left. And on this thing I did a couple weeks ago, for example, they had me against Pat Buchanan. I think on any reasonable drawing of the spectrum, he is a heck of a lot further to the right than I am to the left. And there are people to the left of me who really ought to be balancing out against Pat Buchanan. So I think the people who complain that these shows are tilted to the right have a very valid criticism.
In one of your essays, you write that a gaffe is when a politician tells the truth. Would you explain?
Well, the example there was back from the 1984 campaign. Gary Hart got in terrible trouble when he was still running against Walter Mondale for making a speech saying how glad he was to be in California, or no, how sorry he was that his wife was getting to campaign in California and he was having to campaign in New Jersey. And Walter Mondale made a tremendous stink about this insult to New Jersey. And of course, Walter Mondale knew perfectly well that anyone would rather campaign in California than in New Jersey. There have been some gaffes already in this campaign, which involves someone saying what everybody, either something that's true or what everybody is widely known to think, only you're not supposed to say it. And then as soon as you say it, everyone else accuses you of saying this terrible thing. For example, we have to cut Social Security, I would say would be a rather serious example of it, that you can't solve the budget deficit without taking a bite out of entitlements. Or, of course, the greatest gaffe of all is we must raise taxes, which every person who has seriously studied the budget knows to be the case, that in order to straighten out the budget deficit, we have to tackle both entitlements on the one hand, such as Social Security, and raise taxes on the other hand. And yet anyone who says that immediately gets trampled upon by all the other candidates who say this is a terrible thing to say. And that is, of course, the ultimate gaffe. But it's a gaffe because it's true.
I see your point. My guest is Michael Kinsley, and he's the editor of The New Republic, and he writes the TRB column, which is also syndicated. His new collection of essays is titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. We'll talk more about journalism, politics, and social issues after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Kinsley is my guest. A few years ago, you resigned for about 2 weeks from the New Republic over a story that you wanted, a story that you didn't write, that another writer wrote, but you were editing, and you wanted it published, and your, was it the publisher who killed it? Or?
Well, it was the editor.
It was the editor, okay.
And also, who happens to be the owner.
Right, okay. There you go. The story, why don't you explain what the story was about?
It was a story, this was in the lead-up, it was 1979, it was the lead-up to the 1980 election, and Edward Kennedy was running for office, and we had a piece by a woman, a feminist, making a feminist argument that that the reports of Kennedy's philandering were a relevant issue for the political campaign and ought to be a subject of debate. And I felt that this was an important matter that should be discussed. And leaving aside what happened back in 1979, this very same issue came up again, of course, with Gary Hart earlier this year, and journalists were pulling their hair out saying, should we be publishing this sort of thing? And my feeling is definitely yes.
Why definitely yes?
Well, you know, there are several reasons. The author of this article made a rather serious one. I have a rather less serious one. It's a question of hypocrisy. And it's not just that Gary Hart said, look, you can follow me around, I'm not having an affair. Every politician paints a picture of his life, which he wants the voter to buy, or she. If a politician ever said, look, I don't want anything about my private life in the paper, therefore I don't want you to interview my wife, I don't want you to take pictures of me and my children coming out of church, I don't want any reports about my volunteer activities or anything like that, oh, and also I don't want you to write about my mistress, I would say, well, that's fine. That's a very consistent position. This guy wants to be judged on the issues. But they don't say that. They want you to write about their wives and children and volunteer activities and how often they go to church, but they don't want you to write about their mistress, so or whatever else they're trying to keep hidden. So what they're really protecting is not a politician's privacy. What they really want protected is their hypocrisy, and that's why I think it's perfectly okay to write about it.
Now, you resigned over this.
Well, you know, office politics always sounds a little ridiculous in retrospect. It had to do more with I am not the owner of the magazine, and I actually feel very strongly that you know, capitalism is capitalism. If the owner gets to decide in the end, and I don't have any problem with that. Every week there are things in the New Republic that if I were really running the show, I wouldn't publish, even though I am the editor, and that's fine. And there are things which the editor in chief and owner puts in because of me that he wouldn't publish if he had his way completely. My problem there was I felt that it was a matter of cowardice, not a matter of principled disagreement. But, you know, you get older. I don't know if I would, I may not have the same principles today I had back then. Maybe I've sold out. Who knows?
Do you think we're going to have any Democrats running for president?
Oh, I think, you know, I was very glad to see this little episode over Judge Ginsburg and the marijuana, in part because I thought it was about time a conservative got the same kind of treatment from the press that liberals have been getting, sort of small things blown out of proportion and cause them to withdraw. Sure, no, I think, look, in the next few months, most of the candidates in both parties are going to be eliminated. one way or another. That's not anything abnormal. That's democracy. And in the end, there will be one candidate from either party.
Did you get a good laugh, so to speak, from the Just Say No administration trying to appoint a judge who had confessed to smoking marijuana a couple of times?
Well, I think what gave me the best laugh was the sight of President Reagan and Senator Orrin Hatch and other conservatives during that brief period before they pushed him overboard, saying, well, what's the big deal? So he smoked a little grass back in the – or he experimented with marijuana, which is the way they put it, back in the 60s and 70s. It shouldn't be held against him now. It was a youthful indiscretion, all of which is perfectly true, but it's not the kind of thing you hear them saying ordinarily.
In one of your columns, you wrote, as conservatives discover judicial activism, liberals may discover judicial restraints. And you say in one of your columns that you think the judges that Reagan has tried to get appointed so far is a case of the chickens coming home to roost for liberals who support Roe versus Wade, who supported that kind of constitutional activism.
Well, for the past two or three decades, since 1954, it's been sort of an anomalous situation. You had judges imposing liberal social policy through the courts. I support most of those decisions. Some of them I have a problem with. Roe v. Wade, the abortion decision, is one of them. I believe in a woman's right to choose abortion. I don't believe it's in the Constitution. And I think it's very dangerous to get addicted to having judges do your political work for you, as liberals have done, for the precise reason that you're going to have a conservative judiciary, or very well could someday. Reagan has appointed an enormous number of judges. Now, Reagan and the conservatives claim that they believe in judicial restraint. They think judges should interpret the Constitution narrowly, should not be making social policy in the name of constitutional interpretation. However, naturally they believe that when they're trying to oppose the liberal judges who've been doing that. When you have a conservative majority in the judiciary, you could well see conservatives doing exactly what liberals were doing. And in fact, that has happened in the early part of the century for several decades. The conservative judiciary and judges naturally come from the upper class and upper middle class and do tend to be conservative as a matter of social distinction. In those days, judges overturned worker health and safety laws all under the rubric of freedom of contract, which they claim to find in the Constitution. So it's a kind of judicial arrogance that can boomerang. And what we know about Judge Ginsburg, which is not very much, I think that might have been a serious problem with him.
Michael Kinsley is my guest. He's the editor of The New Republic and author of a new collection of essays titled Curse of the Giant Muffins. I want to talk a little bit about your life and your career. You've written, my adult life began when I arrived at an elite Eastern university from the Midwest as a second-generation American-born ethnic Jewish. And after 70 years of climbing by three generations, I was poised for a final assault on respectability. Well, what exactly was the nature of your assault on respectability?
Well, that was in a piece I was talking about the various forms of social snobbery and arguing that in our society, and it's really a compliment to our society, reverse snobbery is much more common than normal snobbery. What I went on to say in that article is, in the world of the Eastern elite, as described by Henry James and Edith Wharton, a person like that, like such as myself, would feel oppressed by snobbery at every turn. But yeah, and I think this American society is democratic enough that I'd never felt it. On the other hand, there are occasions when people put on great airs of reverse snobbery.
I know that's what you were talking about, but let me ask you again about your assault on respectability.
Well, I guess I don't know. Someone else will have to judge whether I've managed to climb the peaks of respectability.
No, but you said you were trying to assault it. I was curious what you did back in the days when you were assaulting respectability.
that was just a joke. Don't force me to don't force me into a corner on that one.
Okay. Did you get politically radical, though? Culturally radical?
Everyone always says this, and I say it too. I think my politics are just about the same as they were back then. Back then, in the late 60s, early 70s, and during the middle of the anti-Vietnam movement and so on, I was considered sort of a reactionary because I was only against the war and wasn't against all aspects of American society. And now the pendulum has swung so far that, you know, I'm more or less where I am and I'm considered fairly far left. No, I was sort of a reactionary in the mood of those days.
You're perhaps one of the only or one of the few people who's actually defended yuppies in print?
Well, don't you feel a little sorrier for them now than you did maybe when a few months ago? Or I?
You mean since the crash?
Since the crash, sure. They're now called, we have a piece in the New Republic this week about puppies, previously upward professionals.
You've written a book, and you're someone who's written that nobody really reads books anymore. All they do is they read the reviews of the book, but in the interest of sounding really smart and intellectual, they say that they actually read the book. Is this going to be the fate of your book, do you think?
Well, I sort of hope this book, in a way, is the equivalent of fast food. You've got lots of little, none of the pieces in it is longer than 3 or 4 pages. So I have to hope people will more people will read it. Of course, I'm really interested in people buying it. I don't really care whether they read it or not. I got a book that came into our reviewing department yesterday that I'm sure is a perfect example of my thesis that people buy books and don't read them. It was this big, thick book called Perestroika by Mikhail Gorbachev. And it's it's one of the big books of the fall season, and thousands and thousands of copies are being printed and no doubt will be bought. And I'll just bet you nobody actually sits down and reads it. At least I'm not going to, are you?
Oh. You said in one of your pieces that to test if people actually read the books that they said they'd read, you distributed several hundred books with a note inserted into the middle of the book saying, did you really do that?
Oh, we absolutely did that.
Explain what you did.
We took those little yellow stick'em things, you know, that pad, little notes, little stick'em notes, and stamped on them. If you see this note, call the New Republic. We put the phone number, and we'll give you $5. And we put them about 3/4 of the way to the end of a bunch of what were then best-selling nonfiction books in various Washington bookstores. And several hundreds, an exaggeration. I can't remember the exact number, maybe about 100. And the point was, you would never come across this note unless you actually turned that page. It wouldn't fall out of the book or anything like that. And we did not get a single response. Now, it could be that people would see this and laugh it off, or it could be the note would fall off, or it could be that the book wasn't bought, even though we did it at the books at the top of the pile, and these were books that were selling well. There's any number of explanations that would explain if you only got 2 or 3, but to get no responses at all, I thought was sort of revealing.
Are you in the middle of writing a TRB column now?
No, thank goodness. I wrote mine a couple days ago.
What was it about?
Well, this was the one about the problems with the budget, where I came within 1/4 inch of a plea for leadership, but pulled back from the edge of the abyss in the nick of time.
One of the things that I think you're very well known for as a writer is your sense of humor. Did you ever want to be a humorist? You are, in a way, a humorist, because most of your pieces are humorous pieces. But did you ever just want to write comedy?
Well, I don't know. Art Buchwald has the most successful political columnist in America. So sure, it's something to think about. Some of the negative reviews of this book in conservative publications have sort of taken the line that this guy's just a jokester, and isn't it a sad commentary on American liberalism that this jokester is taken seriously? I think I'm more than a jokester, but I do think that jokes are important. I mean, not just for their own sake, but it's important in trying to describe the world in general, and certainly the world of politics in particular, to keep in mind that a lot of what goes on is completely ridiculous, and the only way you can really make that point is by being humorous about it.
Well, Michael Kinsley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Michael Kinsley. He's the editor of The New Republic and writes the syndicated TRB column. His columns have been collected into a new book titled Curse of the Giant Muffins and Other Washington Maladies. It's published by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jerry Falwell. He recently resigned as head of the Moral Majority, and he's just written an autobiography, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, it's Howdy Doody time with Stephen Davis, who used to watch the show from the Peanut Gallery while his father directed it. Stephen Davis has written a new history of Howdy Doody called Say Kids, What Time Is It? Also, Bob Brosman returns to play a couple of tunes on his National Steel guitar. And Ken Tucker reviews director Robert Altman's film O.C. and Stigs. The movie was never released theatrically, but now you can see it on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. President Reagan and congressional leaders today announced agreement on a 2-year deficit reduction package. The plan cuts the deficit by $75 billion over 2 years and includes about $23 billion in new taxes. At the White House today, President Reagan gave his qualified support for the compromise.
This agreement is probably not the best deal that could be made, but it is a good, solid beginning. It provides the necessary services for our people, maintains our national security, and does so at a level that does not overburden the average American taxpayer.
About a quarter of the spending cuts contained in the package for this year come from the defense budget. The White House says, despite today's agreement, President Reagan will sign an order cutting $23 billion from the budget, as called for by the Graham-Rudman law. The automatic cuts can be rescinded if Congress approves the compromise announced today. In Geneva today, U.S. and Soviet arms negotiators agreed on an exchange of visits to nuclear test sites in each other's countries. The visits are set for January. 5 or 6 months later, the agreement calls for joint experiments to develop technology to monitor compliance once a weapons pact is completed. On Monday in Geneva, Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze have scheduled meetings to complete plans for next month's summit. But in Washington, one part of the summit plan is in jeopardy. A growing number of senators and congressmen, especially conservative White House supporters, oppose letting Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev address a joint session of Congress. Critics say only leaders of democracy should get the honor of appearing at the Capitol. After 8 years in exile, two revolutionary leaders are expected back in El Salvador in the next couple of days. Michael Beatty of member station KUSP is in San Salvador and filed this report.
The vice president of the Democratic Revolutionary Front, Rubén Zamora, is expected on Saturday, and the president of that group, Guillermo Ungo, is expected on Monday. Both men belong to a legal organization, the SDR, which is the political wing of the armed rebel movement currently fighting the government. They will be accompanied by delegations from Europe and the U.S. to ensure their safety. Some members of the Salvadoran parliament have called for Zamora and Ungo's arrest, while others are calling on the two men to disassociate themselves from the armed rebels. They have been in exile since 1980, and they are expected to participate in next spring's local elections. However, increased activities by the so-called death squads in El Salvador are leading observers to speculate on just how long both Zamora and Ungo will remain on the Salvadoran political scene. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Beatty in San Salvador.
The U.S. will soon have a new Secretary of Defense. Today, the Senate overwhelmingly approved Frank Carlucci for the post. The vote was 91-1, with the only no vote coming from North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms. The Carlucci nomination drew praise from most senators, including Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
The committee's unanimous approval of Mr. Carlucci reflects the committee's highly favorable assessment of both his substantial experience in national security affairs and his outstanding policy-making and management skills.
Carlucci replaces Casper Weinberger, who retired after 7 years on the job. The Senate Judiciary Committee has set December 14th as the date it will begin hearings on the Supreme Court nomination of Anthony Kennedy. But the committee doesn't expect to vote on the nomination until January. Some liberal organizations wanted hearings to begin later to give them more time to study Kennedy's record. The Labor Department reports that inflation was up 0.4% on the retail level last month. It was spurred on by higher costs for buying and financing new cars, increased costs of owning a home, and bigger price tags for fall and winter clothing. News of a budget cut in Washington seemed to have had little impact on Wall Street today. Stock prices closed mixed in heavy trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 18 points to 1913.63. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last month's panic on Wall Street brought back memories of the 1929 stock market crash, which was followed by the Great Depression in the 30s. On today's performance piece, guitarist Bob Rosman has a couple of tunes which were written during those Depression days.
Back in the Depression, many songs were written with two ideas in mind for escaping the blues of the Depression. The first told people to go out dancing wildly to lightning-fast jazz bands and speakeasies and nightclubs and forget their troubles at a high rate of speed. The other set of songs celebrate the less extravagant times to be had at home, at the hearth, enjoying the free things of life that are best. We'll start with the former idea, a jumpin' Fats Waller tune called Zonky, a minor key jazz swing number, and I'm accompanying myself on the National Steel Guitar, a resonator instrument from the 1920s.
Dum bottle do, what that did a lot of huddle do, gab a did a lot of what that did a down. A lot of did a lot of huddle do, don't bottle a lot of did a scuttle a do, dab a gabby do, bobby do, bobby did a lot of water, a lot of do. A lot of did a did a do, dab a kid a lot of water, a lot of huddle do, dab a did a lot of water, a lot of did a dip a lot of boom. Dab a did a lot of huddle, skid a lot of do, da da do, down. Gabby do, bobby do, bobby did a lot of what that dump, bottle a lot of water, a lot of down. Time to start. Dancing zonky, time to cut it loose, get honky tonky. Is it gonna excuse to let your feeling run wild? Shake your feet a plenty, don't be hard at work. Level 20, I mean 40, making noise and entry, acting like a big child. I got such, well, you know what I want to say. Hot much, that tempo sure is hot that way. Well, I'll bet a dime against a donut, oh, the next day may come and go. But when you do the zonky, mama will shake that thing. Gets a donut, all the rest of them may come and go. But when you do zonky, mama, what you talking about, son? Home now, mama, you will shake that thing.
The next tune I'd like to play for you is one of those at-home, at-the-hearth type of songs. In fact, it's called Home, written in 1930 by Peter Van Steeden as a pop song. And I'll be cloning myself here electronically and playing a couple of rhythm guitars and Hawaiian guitar through the wonders of modern science. A little nostalgic song called Home.
Conceal that setting sound. watching, honey, one by one, always one by one. Night covers all and every fortune just may forsake me. My sweet dream, Lord, they ever take me home.
Bob Brosman recorded those songs for us at member station KUSP in Santa Cruz. Brosman writes a column for Fretz magazine. His latest album, Hello Central, Give Me Dr. Jazz, is on the Rounder label. This is Fresh Air.
Say, kids, what time is it?
While many baby boomers stayed glued to the TV weekdays at 5:30 for the Howdy Doody show, Stephen Davis was one of the lucky ones. He was a frequent member of the Peanut Gallery because his father, Howard Davis, worked at NBC and became the director, then chief writer of the program. Stephen Davis grew up to be a rock critic. After writing books about reggae star Bob Marley and the heavy metal band Led Zeppelin, he decided to return to Dutyville. His new history of TV's first hit show for children is titled Say Kids, What Time Is It? I asked Stephen Davis if he used to enjoy the Howdy Doody show.
You know, one of the problems with the Howdy Doody show is that it went off the air so long ago that I didn't really know if I enjoyed it or not. I was kind of shocked when I went back to do the research and got the old kinescopes at how exploitative and how vulgar the show could be. Howdy Doody was an incredible merchandising success. Over 600 items were sold via the show. So a lot of the shows you can't put on today simply because they're mostly advertising and merchandising pitches.
Well, that takes care of the exploitative. How is it vulgar?
Well, let me take that back, Terry. I don't really think it's vulgar in this sense, except in the sense that the commercialism on the Howdy Doody show was so blatant as it probably didn't look so bad in the 1950s, but within the context of the late 1980s, the post-Sesame Street generation, the commerciality on the Howdy Doody show looks relentless and very intrusive and indeed kind of vulgar.
For our listeners who don't remember the show or who, in fact, never watched it, can you just review who some of the characters were?
Sure. The Howdy Doody show was on NBC every weekday at 5:30, around the time when Mom was getting dinner together back in the secure 1950s. And the show centered around a mythical town called Dutyville, which was and Dutyville was presided over by a puppet named Howdy Doody and his human sidekick, Buffalo Bob Smith, actually. And some of Buffalo Bob's cohorts included Princess Summerfall Winterspring, or I should say the legendary Princess Summerfall Winterspring, and Chief Thunderthud, And most of all, Claribel. His whole name was actually Claribel Hornblow, but Claribel was a mute clown who signified yay or nay by either honking a horn that he wore on a box around his belt or else by squirting other members of the cast with a vicious blast of cold seltzer.
There was also a studio audience of children, and they were in what was called the Peanut Gallery. One of, I think, the shocking revelations in your book is that Claribel, the clown, was the disciplinarian for the kids in the Peanut Gallery.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the first great bouts of disillusionment underwent by many of the kids who were members of the Peanut Gallery. As it turned out, Claribel was indeed an agent of social control. And a lot of people I talk to have very strong memories of being told to shut up by Claribel just prior to airtime. But you have to remember that this was a live network show, and the commercials had to be performed properly, and the last thing they wanted were a bunch of unruly 7-year-olds yelling during the ads. So just before airtime, Claribel's trick was to tell the kids very harshly to shut up, and it would blow the Peanuts' minds completely. They had no idea that, A, Claribel would speak, and B, that he was he was kind of the cop in Dutyville.
You write in your book that one of the ugly secrets of the Howdy Doody show was that you had to know someone to get into the Peanut Gallery. You had to have a connection.
Yes, one of Dutyville's dark secrets was that the Peanut Gallery was not open to the public. And this really became a shock to American people because back in the early 1950s, it was considered immense family prestige to be able to see your child live on the Howdy Doody show. Unfortunately, the Peanut Gallery only had space for 40 kids, and this was rather rigidly enforced by the local New York fire marshal. And so you had to know somebody. You had to know a cast or a crew member, or even better, one of the show's advertisers or merchandisers.
I always wanted to know how Howdy Doody got the look that he did, vaguely Western, with a flannel shirt and a bandana around his neck, dungarees, cowboy boots. Never really made sense to me. What was the image about?
Well, it really, you know, Howdy Doody was born on the radio. He started out as a radio voice of a New York disc jockey named Bob Smith. And Howdy's original name was Elmer. And he appeared on a Saturday morning quiz show that Buffalo Bob did in those days called the Triple B Ranch on the NBC radio network. And he had this really dumb kind of yokel voice, which kept saying, "Howdy doody, boys and girls." And the reason it became a Western voice was because that was what the Elmer voice sounded like, kind of a rube, a cowboy, you know, somebody from the frontier, a rough dude, so to speak. And that's where Howdy Doody and the chaps and jeans and dungarees come from.
Then there was Claribel, who was played initially by Bob Keeshan, who went on to become Captain Kangaroo. Now, I didn't know that. Was that common knowledge that the guy who played Claribel was later Captain Kangaroo?
Well, the whole Claribel and Bobby Keeshan story is a really fascinating one. Claribel started out because Bobby Keeshan was an NBC page who worked for Bob Smith. And he started out handing presents to kids in the Peanut Gallery. And one day, an NBC vice president named Warren Wade got tired of seeing this guy in a sports jacket. And he said, "Someone put a clown suit on that guy." And overnight, at least by 1949, Claribel was, in many ways, the national figure to have come out of the Howdy Doody show, this mute, anarchist, seltzer-spraying clown. The great irony in the Bob Keeshan story is that he led a labor walkout 2 years later, and they fired the whole cast of the Howdy Doody show. 2 years later, he showed up again on CBS as Captain Kangaroo and was on the air for another 30 years. You know, it's the longest network run in the history of television.
Then there was Princess Summer Fall Winter Spring. When she left the show, she had the beginning of a terrific career.
Yeah, it's true. Princess Summer Fall Winter Spring was introduced to the Howdy Doody show in 1950 because they didn't think that enough little girls were watching the show. They thought Howdy and the Doodyville gang were too masculine. So after some false starts, they hired a beautiful 16-year-old actress named Judy Tyler. And she was really a sensation. She had been a dancer at the Copacabana nightclub in New York at the age of 15. And when she went on the air in late 1950, she caused a national furor. It was the first time that a beautiful adolescent girl had ever been on American television. And she was so gorgeous and so talented that even some of the Peanuts noticed that their fathers were coming home early to watch the princess cavort on the Howdy Doody show. And indeed, eventually she outgrew her role and in around 1954 left the show and did some Broadway. And then she went to Hollywood and had a screen test, which was seen by Elvis Presley, the Big E himself. And he said, "I want this girl for Jailhouse Rock." So Judy Tyler, Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring, was Elvis Presley's co-star in Jailhouse Rock. And one of the great tragedies in Say Kids, What Time Is It? Was I learned that 4 days after finishing filming Jailhouse Rock, Judy and her husband were killed in a car crash. And Elvis was so upset that he refused to see the movie. So it's another irony that neither Judy Tyler nor Elvis Presley ever lived to see what was probably Elvis's best movie.
You attribute the demise of the Howdy Doody show to the birth of the Mickey Mouse Club.
Right. The Mickey Mouse Club came on in late 1954 and at 5 o'clock, and it pretty much devastated Howdy. By the time Howdy came on at 5:30, Uncle Walt Disney's very attractive gang of Mouseketeers really had taken over the minds of American children, me included, and my father worked on the show. So, yes, the mouse from California had a big hand in killing Howdy Doody.
Do you think Buffalo Bob Smith still wants to revive the show?
Oh, he's trying to. They're, over Thanksgiving weekend, they're on the Fox Broadcasting Network, there's a two-hour 40th anniversary. Yeah, I think that everybody involved with the show would like nothing better than to get it back on the air on a regular basis.
Tell me the truth. Do you think it's worth reviving?
Oh, I hope they don't revive it. I really think that Howdy Doody deserves a dim corner in the memory of the baby boom generation instead of a bunch of grandfathers running around in makeup. Although, on the other hand, I certainly miss the flying seltzer and the spontaneity and that wonderful bray of 40 hysterical children's voices that I used to hear in the Peanut Gallery. That stuff will be with me all my life.
Stephen, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much.
Stephen Davis is the author of Say Kids, What Time Is It? This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we have a budget, apparently. That means negotiators have come up with some budget that will actually work and can get through the Congress. And that means we have a deficit, and the deficit is apparently small enough to keep the Graham Rudman Hollings Act from kicking in. We'll have a report. Also, the peso has been devalued in Mexico, and that's causing serious problems, or at least economic disruptions, around the border between the U.S. and Mexico. Some more information on the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge Kennedy, and local heroes. Record companies are getting very interested in local rock and roll bands, and it's proving to be a boon for the bands and also makes for some diversity in record store shelves.
Okay, well, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1985, director Robert Altman made a movie called O.C. and Stiggs. It was never released to movie theaters, but it's just come out on video cassette. Ken Tucker has a review.
Robert Altman, who directed hit movies like MASH and The Long Goodbye, and who has at least one dreamy masterpiece under his belt, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, has hit a bad patch. His movies in the 80s have been commercial flops. O.C. and Stiggs was deemed such a failure in advance that it's bypassed a release in theaters and gone straight to video cassette. Seeing O.C. and Stiggs, you pretty much understand why the business people involved in this project think it's doomed. Based on the National Lampoon cartoon characters created by Todd Carroll and Ted Mann, O.C. and Stiggs was undoubtedly intended by Altman to be the last word in teen movies, the film that would finish off a genre. Instead, it merely self-destructs, going up in a burst of bad jokes. In O.C. and Stiggs, Daniel H. Jenkins and Neil Barry play a pair of rowdy teenagers who spend their lives playing pranks and getting into trouble. They have a wiseacre answer to everything, but their sniping isn't funny, it's just boorishly rude. Take, for example, this bit of repartee between O.C., Stiggs, and their high school guidance counselor.
I know that there's a lot of excitement thinking about the summer and all, but I wanted to know if either of you two have given any thought to your summer plans at all. Mr. Stiggs?
Yes.
Mr. Ogilvie?
Mr. Granger? They're not really plans. It's more of a strategy.
Mm-hmm. Oliver, is it? Oliver Cromwell Ogilvie.
Just OC is fine. It stands for out of control.
Mm-hmm. And you're Mark?
Yes.
Mind if I call you Mark?
Yes. I want you to call me Stiggs. It sounds more ridiculous.
Who could care about such jerks? On the surface, OC and Stiggs was a smart movie idea for Robert Altman. He spent his career making charmers out of raffish hooligans. Just think of Elliot Gould and Donald Sutherland in MASH, Elliot Gould and George Segal in California Split, Elliot Gould and his cat in The Long Goodbye. If Altman had been able to successfully apply his buddy-buddy technique to a teen comedy, he might have come up with a box office hit. But Altman shows no particular insight into 80s kids. If anything, he seems bored and annoyed with them. He has more fun here directing veteran character actors like Paul Dooley, Louis Nye, and Dennis Hopper. In fact, this oddball casting provides O.C. and Stiggs with its chief interest. It's a sure bet that no other movie will ever include both African pop star King Sunny Ade and Tina Louise, star of Gilligan's Island. But that's all O.C. and Stiggs is, an aimless curiosity from a talented director. Other new video cassette releases include Extreme Prejudice, director Walter Hill's modern-day western starring Powers Booth and a nearly immobile Nick Nolte, and Who's That Girl, a grand flop of a screwball comedy that put a dent in the movie career of its star, Madonna.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with screenwriter and actor Don Opper. When he wrote the screenplay for Slam Dance, his latest film, he hoped to play the lead, but wound up playing a thug. His movie is directed by Wayne Wang. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new 3-record set of previously unreleased 45s by tenor saxophonist Ike Quebec. And television critic David Bianculli will discuss the new style of shock talk shows, as epitomized by the Morton Downey Jr. Show. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.